Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. From time to time, we invite New Bedford Mayor John Mitchell to the show to talk about some of the issues affecting the city and its residents. Welcome back. Always good to see you.
Always great to be here, Mindy.
And we'd love to hear from listeners. If you have questions for the mayor, 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. A lot happening in the country right now, and New Bedford is ground zero for some of it, right? Including ice raids and offshore wind leases. Yeah. So let's jump in first with the ice raids.
Sure.
They're happening across the country. They seem to be intent on instilling fear. Are ice agents in the city regularly, and what are you hearing from New Bedford residents about these raids?
Well, overall, it has, as you might imagine, it's been a source of tremendous anxiety in our immigrant community. I mean, we have a sizable immigrant community from not just Central America, but the Caribbean. We have a growing Afghan population. I mean, all these folks are wondering, geez, am I able to stay? You know, and at this point, we've had over 50 arrests of immigrants in the city since Trump took office. And these are people, some of them have had criminal records, but it turns out that that's actually a fairly small minority. Most of these are just people who are working. That's it. They're working tough jobs. They're sending a few pennies home every month back to their families. It's a shame. It's not just. I mean, obviously, we've had. It goes without saying, I think, that a lot of it is being done for show by the Trump administration, so much for the rhetoric around focusing on criminals. Everybody could, I think, most people would support the proposition that we should remove criminals from our streets, regardless of where they're from. But it's gone far beyond that. And it underscores, frankly, the need for comprehensive immigration reform. We can all agree that there should be a secure border. There should be some clear rules around asylum. There should be a clear pathway to citizenship for people who've been in this country since they were kids and have only known really the United States, but they still don't have status now, immigration status, much less citizenship. These are, you would think, some pretty common sense solutions, but there's no move forward in Congress right now, and that's because the president is sort of calling all the shots. Yeah. But it affects real people.
How scary, too, if you've been here, you're going to be go to a country you know nothing about, right? I mean, born here,
we see instances of it, especially people who've grown up in the United States, and since they were, as far as they can remember, and they're sent back to a country they're not familiar with at all. And so, look, I mean, my feeling is you can say this about a lot of what's going on in Washington these days. A lot of it is done. A lot of it is performative. It is for show. It is not about solving problems. Mm-hmm. We do have a problem with immigration in the United States about the clarity of the rules about who can stay and who has to go. And we can have disagreements about that, but ultimately that's what Congress is for, and that's not, none of that's getting done.
What are the impacts on immigrant businesses? Are you seeing some impacts?
Yeah, we are. Yeah, in the near north end, where there's probably our most densely populated neighborhood, and certainly the most densely populated with immigrants. We're seeing store owners, and I've heard it directly from them, who are saying, you know, people don't want to stroll into my store because they're worried about getting picked up. Mm-hmm. And so that's hurting businesses, mom and pop convenience stores and grocers. And so it reverberates into the school system, where we have lots of children.
I'm going to ask you that next.
Children of immigrants, and some of them immigrants themselves, who are at times, we haven't seen mass absenteeism. In the first Trump administration, we saw these sort of spates of absenteeism in schools of immigrant children. We haven't seen that, but it has been unstable for a lot of families, and so you do see some absenteeism at rates higher than what you'd otherwise expect. But it's hard. I mean, you can imagine if you're a kid in school and you're wondering whether your parents are going to get picked up. That doesn't exactly lend itself to a good learning experience.
So, is there anything the city can do to help immigrants feel safe and supported? I mean, what can you do?
Yeah, I mean, so the reality is, so there are some things we can do, and we are doing. For instance, probably the most important thing we do is we just help people understand what their rights are, and we let folks know that there are some circumstances under which ICE has the right to enter a non-public space and some in which it doesn't. And so explaining to people that they have rights and there are people they can get in contact with to explain it further to them and represent them, that's about what we do. But the reality is, look, we're a city, and there's something called the Supremacy Clause in the Constitution. It's the federal government gets to enforce the immigration laws, and so over local objections. I noticed that the mayor of Chicago said that he's going to take steps to prevent ICE from arresting folks, and the reality is he doesn't have the legal authority to do that. So that's unfortunate. So all we can do is just be let people know what their rights are and to be a voice for those who don't have much of a voice.
Yeah. All right, the State Pier in New Bedford is set up to support offshore wind. And for those who aren't aware of how the port of New Bedford and the State Pier are being used, bring us up to speed.
Well, the State Pier, it doesn't have much of a role in offshore wind as yet. It could have a little bit of a role, but it is an 8-acre site smack dab in the middle of the harbor, in a very, very busy harbor. And as its name implies, it is owned by the state, and we've long tried to push the state to advancing development there. It's the main ferry terminal for all three islands, Cutty Honk, Martha's Vineyard, and Nantucket. And so it is a transport hub that works very well for that purpose. What we've tried to do is we want to build on that by doing something that's not dissimilar from what's over my left shoulder right here in Woods Hole, which is to sort of build retail around that ferry site, because we'd love to have more places like Pie in the Sky Coffee across the street, which is terrific. Happy to give them some free advertising. I'll stop in there when I'm here in Woods Hole. But in all seriousness, New Bedford Harbor is a very busy place. It's the port of New Bedford is the biggest fishing port in America, as you know. It's leading the way in offshore winds, despite the drag on that industry now, which I'm sure we can get into. Mm-hmm. But the State Pier itself is a place where we want to bring people down to the water for, among other reasons, not just to generate business activity, but also to get people to see all the stuff that's going on the water so that they can appreciate it more. Mm-hmm. We have tried for many years to impel the state to advance that development. I'm pleased to report that it's actually starting to take hold now at long last. And we've worked closely with the lieutenant governor in particular to try to advance some development in the front that faces back toward our downtown. And so we can have in our very busy marine industrial harbor a whole lot of things that people can walk to and enjoy on the water. It's a big enough place to allow for it.
All right, since you gave a plug here in Woods Hole, I'm going to give a plug. Whenever I'm in New Bedford, I love to go to the Black Whale. You see all the fishing boats there. Yeah. It's such a fun, and you bring the kids, right? I mean, there's a lot going on.
Black Whale's a great restaurant.
And, yeah, it's fabulous,
And it's one of many. I mean, New Bedford has a real restaurant scene now. It didn't a decade ago. It does now. And so people go out in New Bedford. And it's not – and look, for us, I think people have discovered – there was always that potential there because a lot of people didn't want to go out to all the way to – say Providence
some great restaurants.
Well, it does, but like who wants to drive, 35, 40 miles, 40 minutes back to the New Bedford area after a couple glasses of wine, right?
Right,
so like
sure.
let's be real about it, right? So our restaurant scene led mostly more than anybody else by Steve Silverstein, who's built a lot of he was the founder of the Not Your Average Joe's chain of restaurants, which was very successful across the east, up and down the east coast. He came back to New Bedford and has built now five different restaurants, including Cisco New Bedford, which has been hugely successful. So people go out to eat in New Bedford a lot, and especially when there's a show at the Zyterian, it's really hard to get in anywhere.
All right, back to the potential impacts of halting permitting of wind farms in the existing lease areas. That would have that's going to have a big impact, right?
Well, it will have a big future impact. So, like right now, it isn't the policies of the new administration haven't thrown New Bedford into disarray in the moment, right? So we've had a tremendous amount of investment in the hardscape of the port, that is to say piers and dredging. We're in the midst of a $1.2 billion build-out of the port. And the Port of New Bedford has been modernized over the last decade. That's been great, and a lot of that has been in anticipation of the build-out of offshore wind. Right now, of course, Vineyard Wind is still going on. You guys report on it a lot. It's still, so they are, by most accounts, they have 17 turbines powered on. It's going. That's probably why it has not been subjected to the Trump administration's MEAT acts. So that's good. That's still going well and still generating a lot of not work opportunities, but also hotel stays, restaurant visits, all that, all the business activity in the city. But the problem for New Bedford is the pipeline. It's the next wind farm the wind project and the one after that. The New England Wind, South Coast Wind, all these huge multi-billion-dollar projects are really on thin ice right now, and they may well not get off the ground until we have a new presidential administration. The Port of New Bedford's a big place, right? It generates about $11 billion worth of economic output annually. And the little stretch of, 2 miles along the center of the waterfront, it generates about 2% of the state's GDP. It is a very robust place. And so offshore wind is added to that. Its slowdown will not, impact won't set us back, but it won't allow us to grow as we anticipated.
So aside from wind and fishing, what other employment opportunities do you anticipate will come to the city from the port?
Well, there's a lot happening in the port otherwise. One of the things that we've focused on a lot is marine technology. There are some opportunities there. It's in addition to things like cargo and recreational, but New Bedford's actually a fairly sizable recreational port as well, but cargo and marine construction. But one of the things that we've worked on the last few years is positioning ourselves to become a test bed of sorts for marine technology. There is a whole lot of new technologies that we're becoming familiar with, AI and IoT and a number of other big data related technologies that have all sorts of marine applications. And so right now we are what we were trying to set ourselves up to be is this is the best place to test these technologies anywhere. So New Bedford's a place where you can readily, or entrepreneurs readily can put stuff in the water. So if you have an autonomous marine vehicle, right, you can drop it in the water in New Bedford and see how it goes, right? You can't readily do that in a lot of places. Right. So much of the East Coast is sort of privately owned, but we have these industrial facilities that where you can just, and that are municipally owned, where you can just sort of do these things. We're working closely with HUI right down the street here on creating a test bed in our harbor. We just collectively, the New Bedford Ocean Cluster and HUI received a sizable multi-million-dollar grant from the state to do that. With UMass Dartmouth, we're creating a digital twin of the harbor, which will allow us to do a whole lot of interesting testing as well. Mm-hmm. We're building out certain shoreside facilities so that you can have cranes and places to drop those vehicles and other things in. And we're also creating an incubator space with funding from Vineyard Wind that will allow for the convening of marine innovators, as well as to become sort of a thought leader in the space. So there's a lot of stuff going on. Lots of partnerships with research institutions, UMass, HUI, URI, Tufts, so they're doing a lot of work now in the city. So, you know, we look. New Bedford is known as marine matters go, as a place of big shoulders, right? To borrow a term from Carl Sandburg, and as he described Chicago. But we also want to be a place of big brains as well.
Yeah, we're talking with New Bedford Mayor John Mitchell. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address: thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking with New Bedford Mayor John Mitchell. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you have a comment or a question, that's 866-999-4626. Or you can shoot us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, Upper Cape residents have long called for the freight service to Martha's Vineyard to come from a port other than Woods Hole, right? Citing air and noise pollution plus truck traffic. Steamship Authority and some islanders have claimed it would be too expensive. This is, as you know, initially going on for a long time.
Perennial
issue. So where are we at with that? I mean, it seems like it would be too expensive from what I've heard, but, you know, what do you hear? Is that something that's a potentially likely to ever happen?
Well, I'd like to see it happen under certain circumstances. So look, you drive down the Woods Hole, and you can't help but, especially in the summertime, but can't help but feel the congestion. I mean, it's tough for residents here for sure, and I've heard from a number of residents in Falmouth over the years, and they have a point. They've had to endure traffic jams, and again, obviously in the summertime, but it's grown, as I don't need to tell any of your audience that, worse over the years. So, you know, so the Steamship Authority has often looked to New Bedford as the solution, which, you know, makes some intuitive sense. I can tell you that, like, we're not, like, desperate to do that. It's not like, oh, the New Bedford will, we're not like, we're a pretty busy place otherwise, as we just discussed. So it's not like, you know, that's a business line that we desperately need. But I think that there are some businesses that, as we've discussed it with a number of businesses on our waterfront there, there may be an opportunity to do that. I think some of that discussion is picked up, and I don't want to sort of go into too much detail about how that's playing out, just because it's a lot of them.
Don't want to jinx it.
Well, I don't want to jinx it, but I also don't. So I think that's certainly part of it, but I also don't want to sort of raise expectations. It is something that I would support, and we don't want to be sort of the destination for trash. We don't want the sort of the New York style trash barges sort of floating into our harbor, as we just discussed. You know, among other things, we're trying to promote our central waterfront as a place where people can go out to eat. And so, if you're dining by the water, the last thing you want to see is some, you know, massive trash barge passing by, right? So we don't want that. But I think that there are some opportunities for freight service. We have promoted this. There's one outfit that did a number of runs over the last couple of years with UPS trucks from New Bedford to Martha's Vineyard. Some of them may have gone to Nantucket, I'm not sure. But, you know, I'd like to help facilitate those discussions. And I do think some they've picked up recently.
All right,
stay tuned.
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned,
Mindy.
All right,
since we're talking transportation, let's talk about rail service. Finally have rail service starting in New Bedford. And sort of we've heard, I guess, mixed reactions when it comes to the rail. Exciting, but some have complained about the noise. We've had some wrinkles that I think have been worked out by the MBTA. You know, they were talking about it, some delays and things like that. Obviously, always there's some bugs when something's new to work out. But where are we at with rail service?
I think it's, long held, it's a net positive for the region. To promote transportation links between cities is certainly important. You know, we don't refer to it as commuter rail because it's of a length that doesn't allow for commuting in the traditional sense of the term, 5 days a week, 50 weeks a year over the course of a career. It is, after all, just the train segment alone, never mind any commuting, walking, or riding on each end. It's about 95 minutes, right? So that's kind of long. But if you're somebody who wishes to go to Boston once or twice a week, it's not a bad option because you can do work on the train. So that's something that we're seeing. People go into Boston, up to Boston for events as well. We're seeing that people who want to, say, go to a Red Sox game can just jump on the train and seamlessly go all the way there if you have the time mm-hmm. to do that. I'll tell you the other thing that's interesting, too, is that I didn't expect, which was there were college students who were coming back home by train all of a sudden. Yeah. But my youngest daughter goes to school up there, and about a week after it opened up, she just materialized at our train station. She said, "Oh, I just took the subway over to South Station in Boston, and I took the train home, and can you come pick me up at our train station?"
So that hadn't been happening.
So, and then after I dropped her back off to go back up to school, there were a bunch of ostensibly college students standing there with backpacks doing the same thing. So that was kind of interesting. That was unexpected. But overall, I think it's a net positive. It's not, it has long been billed by other elected officials as being this sort of transformational project. It's not that. It's one more good reason to live in New Bedford.
And also, you just talked about Cape Air. They recently launched some direct flights from New Bedford to Logan, right?
Yeah, they did. Yeah, so that just kicked off last week. The first flight was last week, and I think it's an interesting proposition that you can go from New Bedford, take a 15-minute flight to Boston, and then just change gates and go mm-hmm. from there to wherever else planes fly from Boston, right?
Yeah.
London, Shanghai,
not have to
wherever.
Pay that heavy parking and all.
Yeah, so it's my understanding is that the central garage at Logan Airport's about $41 a day.
Yeah, crazy.
And the parking in New Bedford's 10. So
yeah, there you go.
So there you go. Okay, and the TSA line in New Bedford is lickety split, and as opposed to the ones you see in Boston. So I think there's an added benefit there. Look, I don't know whether that's a service in the long run. That's going to last in the long run. But what it suggests is something. What it signals is something that I've also long held, which is that our airport has a catchment area that I think will be attractive in the long run to folks who want to connect to, say, like LaGuardia through LaGuardia or through Newark, or even go down to D.C. or Florida easily. And there's a lot of construction going on at our airport. We just rebuilt both runways. They're brand new. A new terminal is being designed now and will be built in the next few years. Same thing with a new tower. Same thing with a new entrance right off of Route 140. So it will be a very easy airport to get through. It'll be very convenient in the next few years. And as things especially get, Hyannis tends to be a little more seasonal as the island airports are as well. Logan is extremely expensive and hard to get to. And Green is not far as the crow flies, but it's a good 50 minutes to get over there. So what we're trying to do is we don't think we're going to grow so big as to have like the British Airways lounge available for passengers, Mindy, but we think we can be a very convenient place to connect up to a lot of hubs and at least in the Northeast.
We got an email from a listener that says, the South Coast has been in regular periods of drought the last few years. Mm-hmm. Does the city have any idea as to its water limitation in relationship to overdevelopment? Climate change has unexpectedly caused a reconsideration of plans. Does the city have a science guru?
Well, there's a lot to unpack there, but multiple questions. But I'll just say in general, yes, there has been a drought, though not as acute as we had. I think it was 2 years ago or so when we were really concerned about water levels. But water levels are fine. Just so for people who don't know, New Bedford gets its water from what's called the Quiticus Lake Complex in Lakeville. Back in the 1880s, the city of New Bedford bought 3,000 acres of land in Lakeville, Rochester, and that's where it gets its water, which is among the purest drinking water in the United States, and in the Northeast among the most affordable. So we have something good there. The city runs it. It works very well for us right now. The water levels are okay. There hasn't been, it turns out that the demands on the water supply have not been great. You know, the city is, New Bedford's a little over 100,000, but at its peak, it was over 130,000. And so the demand for water by not only residents, but also back, you know, 100 years ago from mills was significantly greater than it is today. There are probably more lawns to water today, but by and large, that we have more water supply than we actually need. So we're okay, even in some periods of drought. Good question.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. Federal cuts to lots of programs, including healthcare, food assistance, and education. Let's start with cuts to education. Mm-hmm. New Bedford's annual school budget is $200 million. 10% of that is federal funding. Did you lose that federal funding?
No, it might be interrupted by... So if we're talking about the big, beautiful bill, it did not... it did not reduce the two main sources of federal funding, which are Title I grants, which are grants that go to school districts that who have served a great number of low-income students, and IDEA grants, which serve districts that have a large number of special education students. That's the bulk of the federal money that we get. There's some other programs like food, USDA food programs and such. So that wasn't really reduced by the Trump bill. We are concerned about the effect of the shutdown, because that some of those income streams might be affected. So we'll keep our fingers crossed. And then you know, you go into other areas unrelated to, not directly related to schools, like the WIC program, which has been in the news the last couple of days. It will run out of. Because of the shutdown and its timing in relation to the beginning of the federal fiscal year, which was last week, the first slug of funds from Congress to the USDA for that program has been held in abeyance, and so they don't have a lot of money, so they may run out of money in the next week or so, and that affects primarily pregnant women, and postpartum women, and that's. You can get into the details of that program, but that's kind of scary because as you might imagine, we have many women who benefit from that program, many families who benefit from the program. But it underscores, again, this is when Congress, when the federal government can't come to a resolution about a budget, it affects real people.
Yeah.
And sometimes very vulnerable people.
Yeah. And the federal cuts to SNAP benefits and health care, how many residents could be impacted, and can the city fill in some of those gaps?
I don't think the city's in a position to fill in some of those gaps. And again, that's just like SNAP benefits. That's the formerly known as the food stamp program. So we, as you might imagine, we have thousands of people who benefit from that program. And some folks push back on that and say, why is the federal government in that business? Some of the folks, the Project 2025 folks would say the federal government shouldn't be involved in any of this stuff. I beg to differ.
Right.
I think most people would say, yeah, the federal government should be providing those resources to vulnerable folks, and whether the state can, is the city's really not in a position to do much. You just don't have the resources to fill the void. The state might, but again, and I think, frankly, that's part of the Trump administration's plan, like get out of the business of all these benefit programs, these entitlement programs, and let the states fill in the gap. And you know what? It's just the federal government, what the federal government does among its domestic policies, what it does best is it provides resources, right? And this is one area where federal resources are necessary because there's a lot of need out there.
I would say a lot of need, and I'm sure your food banks, just like our food banks here, are really having a tough time keeping up with demand, which is increasing every year.
Yeah, we have lines at our food banks, and we have a number of food distribution sites, and they are not hurting for business. These decisions in Washington do affect people. These are not abstractions, effects. There are real programs that people rely on just to go about their everyday lives, and I think a lot of times people others can lose sight of that. But when you see young mothers who are trying to figure out how to feed their kids, well, that's you can turn to the federal government and say, why on earth would you cut cut right. off help for exactly. people like that.
Yeah. All right. Housing costs, of course, on the rise everywhere. Talk about efforts to create more housing stock in the city and help lower income people find affordable options. This is a problem everywhere across the nation.
Yeah.
But you've got some ideas.
Yeah, it is. You know, we issued a housing plan a couple of years ago that we were executing now and continue to and will for until we've done everything in it. But in general, it is all geared to addressing the supply issue. The reason why housing is expensive in the U.S. is that there's just the market has not been able to increase the supply. There are lots of barriers. A lot of them are at the local level in various places, not so much in cities, but in other places. The problem fundamentally, and this comes from most folks who've studied this issue, the housing program at Harvard for one is one of the leaders here, but a number of others have just they look around the country and say, well, it has everything to do with zoning. There are many places, including in Massachusetts, where the prevailing land use rules are about single family homes on large minimum lot sizes, and so that creates a huge efficiency. We use land inefficiently in the U.S., and that constrains the supply of housing. There are other things that we could be doing, right, that we can streamline, and we're doing, and other places could do, which is to streamline permitting, to reduce barriers to developers to getting through regulatory processes, including at the state level. We're removing a lot of that, removing some zoning barriers like minimum parking requirements. These little things do add up, right? Mm-hmm. Especially if you have a housing development that barely pencils. In other words, it's barely profitable. If you can get rid of some things like minimum parking requirements, because parking spaces take up land, and that you have to pay for that, right? Mm-hmm. Then you can help increase the supply. So we're seeing some of that removing these logs, and some of the log jam is freeing up, and we're starting to see more construction. But you know, look, we've also made very clear that in our case, it's a regional problem. It's not just the city proper. It's all of New Bedford suburbs that have to get on the same page. And
it's just like, you know, the islands get very expensive. And so what do they send people to the Cape, right? And now the Cape is too expensive, so we're sending them right to the South Coast.
It's we see some people moving off the Cape to Greater New Bedford. We see some people from northern Bristol County and points west moving to the city, because it's one of the few places in the southern quadrant of the state where there's a lot of multifamily housing. But there's that. But you know what I'd say to folks is that, look, you know, there's this problem's not about to go away until there's mm-hmm. some revisiting of zoning rules across the board and suburban places.
Another thing that you have that we don't have a lot here on the Cape is vacant properties, and you've actually created a position for somebody to identify that, right?
Well, we have. So we've done a lot of work in the space. And look, we if you want to increase housing supply, one good way to do it is just to look at what you already have. Mm-hmm. And so we had, in the wake of going back, you know, a number of years now, in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis, we had a lot of vacancy. Lots of folks were underwater on their properties. And so they were boarded up and held by banks, and the banks weren't exactly moving with all deliberate speed to put them back on the market. And so and that leads to other problems, of course, blighted neighborhoods, mm-hmm. and that invites crime and such. So, you know, a lot of that has worked itself out. There's still a fair number of vacancies. And so among our primary efforts to increase supply is just to work to figure out how to free up those properties. A lot of properties, there's always some level of vacancy. So, you know, an elderly widow passes away and doesn't have a will, house is probated, it sits in probate court for some period of time, sometimes years. And so that house sits vacant. And so a lot of it is as simple as bird dogging the probate mm-hmm. court, bird dogging some of the banks. So we have somebody who does that, and she does a fabulous job with it. So we've been able to reduce fairly significantly the number of vacancies. You know, you're never going to get down to zero for the reason I just mentioned, right? There's always going to be some level of vacancy, but it's a really important starting point. Like, we certainly want developers to be building housing in the city, but let's start with the stuff that's already there.
Yeah. We're talking with New Bedford Mayor John Mitchell. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with New Bedford Mayor John Mitchell. If you have a question or comment, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we do have an email from a listener who says, should single owners of multiple residents be treated as a business rate regarding their taxes?
Yes, but there's an impediment. And the impediment is actually in the Massachusetts Constitution. We cannot, we as a municipality may not assess a property that is a residential property as a commercial property. That's the long and short of it. We've looked at that and we said, geez, wouldn't it make sense? These are really businesses. They're not really residences. And unfortunately, we can't. There's a barrier that's actually, surprisingly, it wasn't just baked into the Mass general law. It's actually in the Massachusetts Constitution.
Eleanor has a great question here. She says, for many years, my husband, an architect and a colleague from graduate school who is now a photographer, discussed creating a book on the architecture of New Bedford. The last time it came up was last month at my husband's 80th birthday. The discussion always stops when it comes to who to contact. If the mayor has any tips beyond the library, all would be welcome. Time marches on. Eleanor, thanks.
Well, tell your husband happy birthday. Happy 80th. That's a big one. So there are a number of folks that I think could help.
Spinner Publications.
So
maybe.
Spinner is a great resource. Spinner Publications is a publisher of has been a publisher of a number of histories of New Bedford, and they are it is a repository of a wealth of historic pictures of the city. So I think that I would check in with them. Joe Thomas is the proprietor, and you can find them on their webpage. That would be one. I'd say Margot Saulnier is the city's creative consultant, right? She's basically the arts director for the city. She would be a great resource for anything having to do with architecture. So you can find her on the city's website as well. Those would be two immediate sources, but if you contact my office, we could probably brainstorm it a little bit more and help you out.
Okay. All right, new police chief. You've got a new police chief who comes from Hartford, Connecticut.
Yep.
And he's got quite an interesting background.
He was a very effective chief, and his name is Jason Thody, and he was a very effective chief in Hartford. He was the chief in Hartford for 5 years and left with a change in mayoral administration there, and came very well recommended by the city's former mayor, someone I know pretty well, Luke Bronin, Chief Thody started in July, and he has been off to the races. He's a very quick study, and you know, he comes into a department that has seen a tremendous amount of progress. Violent crime in New Bedford is down 60% in the last decade.
That's
it is
great.
A very safe city, and property crime has come down 52% in that same period. So it's a very, very different profile of public safety now in New Bedford. But there are, from time to time, opportunities to look under the hood of any organization and say, here are the things that we need to do better to set ourselves up well. The policing in America is challenged by a number of things these days, but not the least of which is a waning interest in the profession. It is very hard. Urban police departments across the United States are understaffed, and we're no exception to that. We're down, we're at the height when I first got in the office, we were at 268 officers. I think we're down to 202 now, significantly down despite recruiting efforts, despite the offering of bonuses to new police officers and a number of other similar promotional measures. So we've gotten more efficient for sure. I don't think we need to get back up to 268, but we do need more than we have now. And so I think that's one thing that he's going to be looking at. But you know, there are a number of things that we have to tackle, and a lot of this sort of falls in the way of sort of the kinds of things that make any organization run well, although they're not exactly, you know, headline news, but just things as mundane as just keeping up with the technology, the maintenance of facilities, and having an updated set of internal policies. I mean, there's a whole list of things that we can be doing. But you know, overall, he will be building on progress, and I think he's the right guy to do it.
All right. So, City Council has filed a lawsuit against your office, seeking a declaratory judgment that says the mayor must seek official council approval for the appointment of Jason Thode as police chief. Without getting too much in the weeds on the details, for some, this seems like a power struggle between branches of government. What can you say about this?
Yeah, I think it has been the practice of not just my administration, but the administrations before mine, not to seek council confirmation of the police chief, because we think the code doesn't require it. And so the council really for the first time has said, well, wait a minute, we think we beg to differ. We have a different reading of the city code, and that's fine. The issue I've had is that they didn't have to go running off to court to do it. They actually didn't cast a confirmation vote. They didn't invite the chief in to question him and then to vote him up or down, which they could have done. I'm sure, differ on the implications of that vote. They instead just went into court and said, you know, asked the court to declare their reading of the city code to be correct. I think it's not ripe for litigation, but I will hear from the court one way or the other. And I think the good news is I think everybody likes the chief, so it's not, in practice, it's not going to have much of an effect.
All right, another listener from a question says, what are some of the biggest frustrations as an elected official?
Oh.
I bet there is a long list.
Yeah, it's different. So I think it's, I'd say this. For me... Yeah, so the legislators might have a different take than someone in an executive position like mine. You know, one of the biggest things that I've always found challenging is just the resource constraints that we faced. I think we have over the years felt a little powerless sometimes to establish a certain level of fiscal stability in the city. Our bond rating's the highest it's ever been in its history. We work really hard to manage the budget, but you know, we have some serious constraints. State aid has up this in the fiscal year that just closed, we actually were getting less state aid than we did in 2008. Mm-hmm. So a huge, huge pressure on our budget there. We don't control the climbing costs of pensions and healthcare. Those are largely dictated by state law, and they consume a big part of the budget. And as a city that's not part of a major metro, we're not enjoying the prosperity that major metros like Boston, New York, Austin, the Bay Area enjoy. So we have to hustle for investment to generate tax revenue to pay for all the things that we need. So, you know, we live in, and I think we do well by it. We're doing just fine, but it's the pressures of scarcity have been frustrating. The good news is when we got federal ARPA funds, the COVID relief funds, we were able to do a whole lot of stuff that we hadn't been able to do over the years, invest in things like cultural facilities and housing and daycare centers and port facilities. And so you look at New Bedford and you say, well, where's the scarcity here? There are cranes all over the place. There's a little bit of a building boom. And so some of that was, frankly, just our seizing the opportunity that came with all this federal funding to build things that we had wanted to get to for a long time. So you're seeing that progress, but it hasn't been easy getting to that point.
Yeah, we didn't mention the cultural institutions, parks, and things like that. Oh, yeah. And there's a lot going on that.
Well, there's some pretty significant expansion. So the Zeiterian Performing Arts Center is undergoing a $37 million upgrade. So they will open back up in January, and Part of the financing stack was ARPA funds. We put in about $6 million in federal COVID relief funds into that project. Same thing with the Bedford Whaling Museum, put a slug of money into their project. They are building out a $32 million expansion right now. It's going to be this big art gallery right across the street from the main building. The YMCA is another one. The New Bedford Art Museum. There are lots of cultural facilities that are expanding right now. They're in the midst of really generational growth, which is great. Mm-hmm. And as you drive down through, especially the downtown, but also other parts of the city, you see a lot of housing going up. The port is just booming with construction activity that's been going on for a while. But one of the reasons why we've been so competitive in landing grants and other big federal grants and other investment is that we took a lot of COVID funds and designed out these projects, and so they were shovel ready, and we could go to the federal government and say, hey, just sign up right here. And so that's worked pretty well for us. Yeah. So there's a lot getting built right now that, we're very, very pleased with.
Yeah. All right. Are we ready for a major hurricane? I know you're not going to wouldn't say please no, we're always thinking about that, right? Preparedness.
Yeah, you have to, and you really do. And it's true right here, obviously in Woods Hole, right? And it just so happens, like, Woods Hole is sort of at the point of Buzzards Bay. You know, it's like sort of around the bend, right? But it's right there. And you look down the street at the NOAA's Northeast Science Center, which was, people here in Falmouth will remember, was rebuilt after the first one was knocked down by Hurricane Carol, right? We're vulnerable here. And so for the city, we've got large populations that are sort of exposed to storm surge. And so we treat it very seriously. We have our hurricane plans have not fundamentally changed since I started in office, except in one respect. There's really two respects. The first is that we practice more often. We do tabletop exercises and such. And we're much more sophisticated about messaging to people about the risks of storms, and we stay on top of that. There's a certain level of constant vigilance that has to be maintained without being alarmist, right? Mm-hmm. You don't want a crying wolf problem, right? It's because people will tune you out. But the other thing is, so it's what's different now, and this is in part informed by a lot of the research that was done right down the street here at HUI, as well as the NOAA Science Center, and that is the flooding maps have changed. And so what that means is fundamentally that there's a higher risk, there may be a higher likelihood for evacuation than there has been in the past. And we have some parts of our South End that are fairly low-lying, that sit outside the New Bedford hurricane barrier, that flood with some frequency, two or three times a year. It's street flooding and such, just from abnormally high tides and a little bit of storm activity. And so those are places that we think that will be especially vulnerable when the next big one comes. Mm-hmm. Not if it comes, when it comes. So I think so what we try to do is, and it extends all the way over here, is try to sort of set the tone for the region. Like, we're not into this. We're not Chicken Little. We're not saying the sky's falling, but you gotta be ready, and so that's what we try to do.
Yeah. Well, we have about a little over a minute left, but I want to mention New Bedford Light wrote an opinion piece last month asking you to forge a more positive relationship with the press, to be more a partner in the efforts to educate New Bedford residents and plans and policies. What are your thoughts on that? How did you respond?
Well, I think our relationship's pretty positive, Mindy. You
with me, you are. Yeah.
That was Ken Hartnett, the longtime editor of that wasn't the paper's opinion piece. It was his. I think he's really talking about the New Bedford Light exclusively, as opposed to other media outlets. You and I have had a very positive relationship over
agree.
The years.
I will agree.
I care to think, Mindy.
Yes, absolutely.
I think some of it has to do with some of the growing pains of the New Bedford Light and what it's trying to become. It's whether it's trying to become a all-purpose traditional newspaper, although based digitally, right? And one that reports on the affairs of the city and the region, as opposed to being purely investigatory journal. And I think there's a tension there that they still haven't quite worked out. So we will be happy to help them work that out.
All right. New Bedford Mayor John Mitchell, as always, thanks for being here. Always good to see you.
It's always great to be here.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Burdery and William Coulter.